The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, the inequality debate, was recorded at Conway Hall in July 2015 on the eve of the budget. The chair is Guardian columnist Zoe Williams.
Hi, everybody. So I kind of realised that we'd reached peak inequality in debate terms when Peter York said, "I'm so tired of this. I keep expecting Gardner's question time to have a question about the inequality between my wisteria and my lilies." And I thought, oh, OK, this is really broken through. Everybody understands. Everybody's on the same page of talking about this. And the differences now are, what's the extent of it? Which direction is it going in? Is it a problem at all? And what can be done? And I think that's kind of, those are very large questions. and I'd like to start with, first I'm going to tell you who's on the panel. Sheila Lawler is head of the right-wing think tank, head of Politeer, is that fair?
Yeah, Politeer.
Will Hutton is the author of, most recently, How Good Can We Be? But obviously the author of many other books as well. David Willetts is a former Conservative MP and author of the first mainstream analysis of intergenerational inequality. Diane Abbott is the MP for Hackney North and Stoke Newington, and Owen Jones is the editor, is the author of The Establishment and Rabble Rouser.
So, I'll go with that. That's fine.
Will you go with that? Good. So Sheila, if I could start with you, can you give us the kind of perspective from the right, if you like? Is it widely acknowledged that inequality is as great as we all say it is?
I'd say, Zoe, that there has always and will always be inequality of income, whatever sort of society one's in. Inequality of earnings, inequality of talent. The question is, for policy, what should government do about it? In my view, the best thing government can do about it is to widen opportunity so that people have a good education, a good chance to make the most of their talents and earn or do what they want with their lives, whether they want to be more, whatever they want in life.
Mm, right. So if inequality is always with us, is there a kind of broad agreement that it's widening or not?
Is there
a broad agreement that inequality is getting more pronounced?
Well, it really depends on your measure, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know. Does
yeah.
it?
It does.
Will, does it? Okay, Diane, does it?
Sure. I mean, I think Sheila's a lovely person, but I think she's being a bit complacent. Certainly in London, which is where I live and where I'm seeking to be Labour's candidate for mayor, just so you know. I had to work that in because she forgot to mention it. The gap, I mean, and this is a statistical thing. In London, the gap between rich and poor is wider than it's ever been. London has more multimillionaires than any other city on the planet. I live in Dorset, in the middle of Hackney. I come out of my front door, I turn right, I'm on an estate where somebody got killed not so many years ago. I turn left, round the corner, I'm on Albion Square, where a four-bedroom family house will cost you the best part of £2 million. That's inequality.
Right. Okay. Will, do you agree with Sheila that equality of opportunity kind of legitimizes inequality of income?
I think it's one thing to say, but I don't think it's by any manner of means enough. I think that there are deep forces over the next kind of over the decades ahead, which are going to create phenomenal inequalities of wealth along with inequalities of income. I think you can already see that in the housing market, but you can also see that in the way the capital markets are operating, more and more companies are being privately owned, and if you want a stake in their success, you can't buy it. You have to be one of the insiders who actually were part of that structure. So you're watching denser and denser concentrations and accumulations of capital. Mm. And I think the reason why one should, there's a moral concern about this. There's, actually in a society in which, people's life experiences don't touch, you actually lose what we hold in common, and I think that diminishes everybody. But my big thing, I would say, is that if you want to create an innovative economy and society in which the mass of people flourish, you can't have it that actually the possibilities of building something fantastic that's new, whether a social enterprise or a startup company or whatever it might be, is actually reserved to tiny, tiny numbers of people. I think it becomes a source of deep sclerosis in our society. So you have the things that offend Diane going side by side with, increasing kind of silting up of what it means to kind of, be alive, in our country. So I think that, we've got to do more than just say we have to educate. We have to break up these concentrations of property and capital. We have to do much more to building countervailing balances to big companies. And we have to do much more to enfranchise ordinary people.
David, can you make a case for the accumulation of capital, or do you reject the analysis that that's the direction?
Well, just going back to your original question, because can I just have a go at those? Because you answered, there are several different currents here I think we need to disentangle. First of all, does it matter? And my view on that has changed in the last 20 years. I would have said back in the 80s that inequality didn't matter. The only thing that mattered is where you were in absolute terms. If people's absolute living standards were rising, how they were relative to other people was insignificant. I do think now that there's evidence that from well-being to delivering social mobility, where you are relative to other people matters as well as how you are in absolute terms. And I think that's a shift in thinking in my party, and David Cameron has been explicit. It's been a shift in thinking amongst Conservatives. On, then, is it, you kind of said, is it all just, do we all agree it is getting worse?
Yeah.
No, I don't accept that inequality in income is getting worse. I don't think the evidence supports that. The evidence is that inequality is less than it was before the crash. Now, you can have an argument about why that is, but it's clear that the top 20%, their incomes were heavily determined by the performance of the financial services industry. So the big reduction in bankers' bonuses and all that, plus the fact that benefits, there was a time, there were some crucial years when benefits were actually rising relative to earnings, has meant that the gap between the top 20% and the bottom 20% has, if anything, narrowed in the part since the crash. That doesn't mean it's necessarily a long-term trend, but the big increase in inequality happened in the 80s and hasn't really deteriorated significantly since. So I don't accept it's got worse on income. On wealth, hard to tell, but certainly that phenomenon that Diane referred to of the surge in the value of assets, notably housing, has meant the gap between people who got their house, who bought a house and bought it a long time ago, and people who either bought a house recently or don't own a house, that gap has got a lot wider. And I see that as heavily an intergenerational issue. So I think we've got to disentangle income, capital. But yeah, I start from the point of view that a society that's got too much, that's got a lot of inequality, is both going to be morally offensive and going to find it hard to deliver equality of opportunity.
Right. Owen?
Well, I mean, on income and wealth, we know those well-known lefties, Credit Suisse, did a report last year. They found that inequality of wealth in Britain, our economy, is the only G7 advanced economy where that inequality has got worse at the beginning of the century. In terms of Of course,
inequality
since the crash. Well, obviously, what tends to happen with financial crises of these magnitudes is you do get, in early stages, a small share, a decrease in inequality, partly as, for example, automatic stabilisers in work benefits and so on kick in. But the long-term trajectory, I think most people agree, on inequality and income is set to get a lot worse, not least because of, for example, what's going to happen tomorrow, the offensive against in-work benefits, for example. But just in terms of inequality, just broadly, you know, inequality starts from birth. I mean, the birth weight of a child from a poorer background is lower than the birth weight of a child from a richer background. By the age of five, one study in Scotland showed that the vocabulary of an affluent child is 18 months ahead of a child from a poor background. We live in a society where in the last few years, if you look at the Sunday Times rich list, which I'm sure you've all been glued to, the wealth of the richest 1,000 people has doubled during the last few years, during one of the great economic traumas in the history of this country, whilst working people have suffered the longest fall in their pay packets since Queen Victoria sat on the throne. And the reason, partly, these forms of inequality matter so much is partly it's very expensive. I mean, the wages of working people, many people, were falling years before the crash. So from 2004 onwards, if you're in the bottom half, your wages started to flatline, and the bottom third, they started to decline. And what that meant was ever-increasing dependency on in-work benefits, subsidising poverty pay. Most people in poverty in work, earning their poverty day after day, and that poverty is subsidised by the taxpayer. This government, instead of increasing wages to a proper level, we're going to see the attack on in-work benefits instead. But also it encouraged personal debt, and we're one of the most personally indebted nations on the face of the earth as people try to supplement their income. So inequality, of course, matters for a whole number of reasons. It's damaging for the people involved, but it's damaging for the economy, it's damaging for the taxpayer, it's damaging for our society as well. And for those, just finally, you know, that point about equality of opportunity, well, look, you know, who doesn't support getting rid of the many barriers that exist to people realising their full potential? I work in the media where unpaid internships, for example, exist. So to get your foot in the door, you have to often work for free, and only people often who can live off the bank of mum and dad can afford to do that. And that's why, according to the government's own study last year, over half of the top 100 journalists are privately educated. All I caution against is, yes, let's get rid of those barriers, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that rhetoric is used to justify inequality, to say that those at the top deserve to be there, they're the hardest workers, they're the best, they're the most intelligent, and the people at the bottom also deserve to be there. They're lazy, they're feckless, they're work shy. That rampant demonisation, I'm afraid, is absolutely pandemic now in our society. The shift from social injustice to the personal defects of the individual, that poverty or unemployment is a personal individual defect that you, the individual, needs to deal with. And all that does is justify the many grotesque inequalities that define our society.
Mm. I mean, wow. You know what side they're on.
Can I respond to several things that Owen said?
You can.
Several things he said. First of all, if he... I agree. Let me forget some of the things I agree with and some things I don't agree with. Mm. On that final comment, whether you are your income and the distribution of your income and to what extent we should see that as some kind of moral judgment on society, it is precisely historically used to be one of the criticisms of free market economists that we didn't see the role of the jobs market as to somehow reward people for their moral worth, because the argument used to go exactly the other way around. We used to say, of course, nursing is a morally valuable activity, more morally valuable than being a pop star, but the returns in the jobs market are neutral as regards moral worth. And if you look at the great Hayek response to Michael Young on meritocracy, you will find in Hayek a beautiful account of how we should not interpret rewards that you get in the jobs market as some kind of moral judgment on people. So what Owen says, his final point, I agree with, but you shouldn't regard that as somehow a left-wing position. The other point I wanted to say is that this debate, in however long we've got, half an hour, whatever, we'll get into a terrible muddle if we keep on slicing and dicing the population in lots of different ways in order to make a particular point. So we move from the top 1,000 or the top 1%, or as I used, the most affluent 20% and the poorest 20%, and then we had earnings of the less affluent half of the population. So putting my cards on the table, where I think the gap has widened, which is a crucial change in the labour market in Britain and America, to my mind, the gap is becoming increasingly between graduates and non-graduates. And I think there's quite power. And if you enter the modern labour market without having gone to university, the evidence is that your wages, sadly, not because you are an inferior person in any way, but your wages, sadly, in the last 20 or 30 years will have underperformed. If you go into the jobs market as a graduate, you, by and large, you will have been provided with the equipment that enables you to ride changes in the external world better. And I think there's some pretty compelling evidence that that's what has driven widening income gaps, both in the US and in the UK.
David, you're missing some things about the structure of the labour market. You said that inequalities narrowed since the crash. Doesn't feel like that's in Hackney, but I'll give you that. That's what you want to say.
Let me complete.
Yeah. My point is that from when I was growing up as a child in the 1960s to now, this is a much more unequal society. But my further point is, it's no good looking at people's incomes at a point in time. One of the things that's happened, it's not just got more unequal over 40 years, but people's stability, people's security has been eroded. Mm. My parents are working class West Indians. They worked in the public sector. My mum was a nurse. Daddy was a factory worker. But they had a stability and a security and a self-respect, which people at that income level now, because of the insecurity and casualisation of the labour market, can't have. And that feeds that sense of inequality.
Can I just deal quickly with the social mobility argument? Sheila, do you, your equality of opportunity, is there a sense in which that is insufficient if conditions at the bottom are so bad that people are living in squalor if they're not, I don't know, clever enough or energetic enough?
If you look at the British labour market and the inequality in the labour market, I couldn't agree more. There is inequality in the labour market. Now let's look at why that is. Do you know that Britain has the highest percentage of unskilled or low-skill jobs in the OECD apart from Spain? 20% of our jobs are low-skill. Now, that makes a huge... That's the highest proportion in Western economies.
I know, but it's often
the disparities are great. And why is it that we're moaning about inequality and people are coming up with... What matters is that people are not equipped... Enough people are not equipped, and I would say this is a fault in the education system. It does go back to that.
Okay.
As they are in France or Germany, to get a decent job and to make the most of their opportunities in life.
But isn't it an ideological decision to say care work is low-skilled? I mean, who says that's low-skilled? Many low-skilled jobs aren't actually low in skill. They are framed as low in skill in order to be low-paid.
Look, exactly. Zoe, look. At the beginning, I said it depends how you measure. And this is part of the problem. If you take somebody's measure, I don't care what measure you use. The measure that I looked at was one from one of the institutes, which said they were using the measure, somebody who doesn't need anything more than a primary level education to do a job. And that's a pretty broad thing. Now, we have 20% of our labour market consists of people like that, and it's far higher than France or Germany or any similar Western European economy. Now, that's a big start for dealing with opportunity, I would say.
Well, do you agree with this?
Look, I mean, it is true that the British economy has an incredible number of low-wage jobs, but I think there's this is such a big story, tomorrow we will be told about all the measures taken to lower this budget deficit and cap debt and all the rest of it. But the Bank of England has been warning for the last 6 months that the number one domestic financial risk confronting Britain is the size of the current account deficit. And one of the reasons why the current account deficit is so big and so threatening, and by the way, it's one of the consequences of having an exchange rate which floats, because we have an overvalued exchange rate, but that's a whole other story, is that we don't have sufficient exports. Why don't we have sufficient exports? Because we don't have kind of a productive heart of our economy that throws up high-wage jobs. Why is that? That is because we have a disproportionate number of what I call ownerless corporations who really chase the share price and under-innovate and under-invest. I was talking to the chief executive of a major R&D-based company who told me last week that he was under immense pressure to spend the £1 billion in his balance sheet not on the next wave of antibiotics, but actually on buying back his shares to support the share price. Mm. And he regarded that as a kind of... He found himself in his immoral back against the wall. He doesn't want to build that kind of company. Mm. So we have a particular kind of capitalism in Britain that is very exposed to the financial markets and their preoccupations, where remuneration of the people at the top is very geared into the share price. They actually find themselves, as a business strategy, kind of under-innovating, under-investing, and displacing risk onto ordinary people, and creating a large reservoir of low-wage jobs, because that's the way they can kind of get through the economic cycle. So it's a big, big story, this. Yeah, it's not just about education or about equality of opportunity. It's about the way over 20 or 30 years we have allowed our capitalist structures in Britain to develop. And my contention is we won't get far in... kind of tackling this problem of inequality. Yes, we do two things. One, associate tackle that. And B, I do think we have to start taxing the right things. We don't tax property and wealth. We do tax income too much in Britain. And I think that's we won't see that change tomorrow. So those two things become big drivers of huge inequality. They are.
Well, Aaron, you want to come back on the Labour market?
I often feel frustrated because comprehensive education, of which I'm a proud product, is scapegoated for many of the ills of society. And, you know, if we have a gap in vocabulary of 18 months by the age of five, there's quite little often comprehensive education can actually do to remedy that. Mm. Or the fact one in four young Londoners grew up in an overcrowded home, and we know that has a huge impact on education. We could go on forever with those factors. It's also worth pointing out that about half of recent university graduates are doing non-graduate work. So the fact they've gone through university, often saddling themselves with huge amounts of debt, is not a guarantee of getting a graduate job. Often you end up getting a job you would have got quite conceivably have got otherwise. But the point about the labour market, I think, is key, and that's this hourglass economy that we have, where we have the growth of middle-class professional jobs at the top, where, yes, if you have a university degree, you have an advantage, but also sometimes if you have to go through unpaid internships, which are inaccessible for large numbers of people. And then at the bottom, you have low-paid, insecure, low-skilled jobs, and you have this missing middle of middle-income secure jobs. I think we should be learning from other countries, because some will say this is an inevitable product of globalisation. Mm. I reject that. Look at Germany, where they have an active industrial strategy. They didn't say, let the market decide, the state doesn't pick winners or losers. They took an interventionist position. They caught the high-tech boom, but then they caught the renewable energy boom as well. Mm. And what that did was mean they could help take on the environmental crisis, but also the jobs crisis. They created skilled, secure jobs, backed up with apprenticeships for young people, as well as a research and development sector. That's the sort of model we should be looking at, not this low-skilled, low-wage economy.
I should say, though, the Germans... The Germans are saying to Greece, let the market decide. Yeah, but that's another debate for another time.
Yeah, David, can I come back?
Because I think two things that Owen said in passing about education are both very bad guides to policy and will make the problems that he genuinely cares about worse. First of all, his point about the language, the vocabulary of 2 5-year-olds. Now, of course, I would like all 5-year-olds to be having a wide vocabulary. But I think that this belief that your fate, your future in life, is determined by your first few years is both wrong and pernicious. It has licensed a dramatic shift in public intervention and spending towards such a focus on the early years, and it's linked often to a belief that if you're a teenager, there's nothing left you can do, adult education doesn't matter. In fact, Zoe wrote an excellent piece about this a couple of years back, and I completely agree with it. The focus, the belief that your opportunities in life are shaped by the experience of the first few years, I think has had some very bad implications for policy. And secondly, what he said about graduate and non-graduate jobs, which is strictly true but deeply misleading.
It is true that some students, when they leave university, are in non-graduate jobs. And I actually agree with some of what he says. I mean, the arts and creative industries in London, with the unpaid internships, and we, under the coalition, absolutely tightened up on the enforcement of minimum wage regulation, for example. There are a lot of graduates who start off in non-graduate jobs, and the statistics that he's citing are for people very soon after university. If you then look at people who are in low-paid jobs, and who are the ones that then move on and move up, and who are the ones who sadly remain stuck in low-paid jobs? The ones who move on and move up are graduates. And if you thought that the other implication, therefore, which is very dangerous in what he says, is, oh, there's already too many people going to university, they're all in non-graduate jobs, why bother? It is exactly the opposite. We need more people going to university, and the fact that some of them are doing non-grad jobs when they leave university is not a reason why they shouldn't go.
I mean, obviously, that's an amusing distortion of everything I said. I mean, the first point was, in no sense do I believe people are condemned by their early years. My point was that we should, of course, invest in early years. That doesn't mean we should shift resources from later years. I went to a school in the bottom 5% of results. I was the only boy in my class to go to sixth form, let alone university, not because I was naturally brighter, but because I had odds stacked in my favour. And I do genuinely believe that if we had also in early years, as well as dealing with the housing crisis, many of those people I grew up with had overcrowded homes, it does have a huge impact. Diet, that's why I support free school meals for all without the stigma of means testing it. Those are measures which will have an absolutely clear impact, and I think those are the things we should be looking at. And the other point I'd make is, as I've said, I mean, the idea I don't think we should have less people going to university is incredible. I mean, it's farcically, obviously, untrue. I'm a passionate believer in university for all who wish to do it, and I spend a lot of time going to schools. I still look like the youngest person in the class when I visit, but when I go there, I spend a lot of time desperately pleading with young people who feel put off from applying to university to do so. But the point I'm making is, at the moment, with this hourglass economy, you have jobs at the top which are often inaccessible to people from non-privileged backgrounds. And I speak as one in an industry, the media, which is notorious at preventing people from, very talented people, from being able to get in. And that's because it discriminates not on the basis of ability, it discriminates on the basis of the wealth of your parents instead. So let's invest in early years, let's deal with the housing crisis, let's deal as well with all the problems in inequality which are reflected in educational attainment, but let's have an industrial strategy where we have middle-income, secure, skilled jobs like they have in Germany.
Sheila.
I think it's quite straightforward.
I'm afraid, Owen, I shiver when I hear industrial strategy.
I'm sure you do.
Listen to me. The reason that Germany, you mentioned all the industries it has, and the reason they have, two things should be noted. One is it's because they have a very good education and training system. They have actually very good academic education for post-16s as well as training. If you want to train to be an engineer and go into Siemens, if you want to go into sustainable energy, whatever you do, you will have a course which is very carefully prepared and very aspirational. And the same happens in France, which despite its woeful economy, is still one of the most productive Western economies and has huge high-skill industries like aeronautical. My point is that where governments can intervene is right across these earlier part of education and training and to create the right conditions. But Germany isn't, you know, blessed entirely by its what you call an industrial strategy and what I would prefer to look on as an education and training strategy. It's got big problems in its labour market. They will tell you they are facing an absolutely impossible way of dealing with the future and paying for their pensions bill. They have a shrinking birth rate. They have problems to deal with public, they have high, their exchange rate is creating a great mess. So all kinds of things happen with economies. But I would say what governments can do, rather than all the hints that we need strategies and programs to intervene at every level, is to have a proper education and training system. Beyond that, it's a matter of political ideology.
Okay.
And the evidence is that the governments in this country have intervened in one way or another since the 1940s. And honestly, if you believe inequality is increasing, you should look at what the government has done to increase that inequality.
So, Diane, we've heard about reforming business, we've heard about industrial strategy, we've heard about changing the way we tax. Is there anything you haven't heard that you think is actually quite an important aspect of addressing inequality?
I think a lot of these issues are connected.
Yeah.
I mean, the classic thing is health inequality. And the classic example of that is if you get on the Jubilee line at Westminster and you go out to Canning Town, at every stop, you lose a year in life expectancy. By the time you get to Canning Town, the people that live in Canning Town live 10 years less than the people that live in the centre of London. But I think all of these things are intertwined. But I do agree with Owen in relation to Sheila. It's not enough to say people must go off and get educated and get trained.
Mm-hmm. It's a start there.
No, but it's not enough. And one of the things...
We haven't tried it.
I think we have. One of the things about the job market now, and one of the reasons I feel so strongly that it's over a decade, it's become more unequal, is that it's about who you know in some of these professions. And I'm going to cite somebody, not Hayek, not a socialist, but Andrew Neil. Okay, who's a Tory, but he comes from a lower mid-class background in Paisley in Scotland. And he said to me once, you know something, Diane, if you and I were starting out today, we could never get where we have got to because we didn't know anybody. A lot of these professions, the law, journalism, the media, it's about who you know. And that deepens and entrenches inequality.
Well, David, do you accept that?
I think... We have to be very careful about this. The media certainly has had a massive transformation. It has gone from being a craft-based culture of entering journalism at 16 to a profession where now a very high number of the people in it had a private education. So it is very dramatic, and if you look at the social mobility measures, it's one of the activities that has changed the most. I personally am not persuaded, I don't think there is overwhelming evidence, that overall social mobility in our country has got worse. I do think that the balance between the generations is what has changed. And in terms of the challenge we had from Zoe about, okay, so what would you do? I think there are several things that we can do. I think the first thing is that the driver of wealth inequality is above all what has happened to house prices. And that is manifestly heavily influenced by the fact that under successive governments, we've not been building enough houses. There is just quite simply a shortage of houses in this country. And I know from my experiences as a constituency MP, all the pressures everyone has whenever there's going to be a housing estate to go out and complain about it. My local newspaper used to regard permission to build a housing estate as bad news and a residents' association stopping the building of a housing estate as good news. That was the narrative, and it is very damaging. Secondly, and here perhaps Owen and I agree, I hope he will welcome the fact that I think one of the big reforms of the last coalition government was to get rid of all the controls that used to exist on the number of people going to university. I think many more people should go to university, and at last that has now become a feasible objective, beginning, as we've seen for the past few years since the changes I brought in, with a big surge in the number of people from low-income backgrounds going to university, which has doubled in the past decade since the original Blair reforms of 2006. So more people going to university, secondly. And the third thing, which goes back to something Zoe said, she referred in part to the care sector. And I think, I'm not persuaded by the evidence overall there is this hourglass economy. I do think there are some sectors where the jobs market and the training system is completely dysfunctional, and social care is clearly one of them. And I don't agree with Sheila on this. I think it is a legitimate, important role of government. Where there is a business sector that has become highly dependent on tax credits and migration, and oddly enough, the best single report on what you could do to boost training and boost skills and lower dependence on tax credits in the care sector was written by Camilla Cavendish, now the head of the Number 10 Policy Unit. So there are things that you can do. And I personally think, if you look at either what's happened in the past 5 years or what we're working on now, I think that there are the levers, some of the levers that you could do to tackle these problems have been correctly identified. And if at the end of this parliament, we've got more houses being built, we've got more people going to university, and we've done something about standards and pay in the care sector, I'll be very happy to come back and on this platform, and in 5 years' time, be judged about whether or not on those three measures progress has been made or
well,
not.
In the care sector, David, I think you've misrepresented me. What I said was, I thought it was very important that people should be properly trained and educated, and I thought this was a proper function of government. Yeah. But what I'd like to mention, Zoe, something that hasn't come up, which does bother me. It's the inequality, and I would say this is a very serious problem, of part-time workers, many of whom are women who go back to work after children are born. They are taking jobs which are of a lower skill than that for which they're equipped, and they end up being poorer. It takes them about 13 years to get back on the pay ladder where they would have been, and they have double responsibility, and I think this is going to be a much more serious problem in the future. We're going to have a big pensions deficit for them, and they will not have the sort of jobs for which they are equipped.
Right, thank you. I'm going to go to questions from the floor because Sheila has to leave at 8. She very kindly stepped in when she had a previous engagement, so she's doing us a massive favour and not just running out.
No. Not to you, I know that.
Has anybody got any questions? Oh, look. Thank you.
David, you mentioned there's a gap between... a gap between graduates and non-graduates. But you know very well the story of Kate Riley, a graduate on benefits, looking for work. And she's just one of many graduates now coming out of university. As you said, the number of people going to university has increased, who is looking for a job, can't find a job, okay? And when she probably does find a job, it will be a low-paid job, a de-unionised job where she won't have the rights to protect it. And this is the kind of thing that is causing this inequality. There's an African proverb that says that if the children aren't initiated into the society, they'll burn it down to feel its warmth. And that's exactly what happened in 2011. These young people, they're excluded from the education system because they don't have the MA. They're excluded from proper employment because the jobs aren't secure or simply aren't there at all. They're excluded from being able to buy houses because they can't afford to buy those houses. And so what do? They turn around and they burn everything down. And your government, we talk about intervention, your government has intervened. Your government has increased this inequality by every single measure that is possibly possible to look at. And it's about time. It's about time. It's about time that you first recognise that, and sorry, I should probably ask you a question here. The question is, when are you going to stop denying what is already in front of your own eyes? Right. Every single time we've had a riot in this country, it's been under a Conservative government, all the way back to the 19th century. When are you going to open your eyes to this inequality, stop denying it, and then actually do something about it?
Well, I think that was today.
I can only go on the evidence I see. The evidence is that the gap between the most affluent 20% and the least affluent 20% is lower than it was pre-crash and remains in the past 5 years of the coalition. I'm no longer an MP. I don't have to engage in these from a particularly particular point of view, but the idea that it's just obvious that inequality has risen on all benchmarks, and sadly, you can believe it if you like, but if you show me the evidence, I'm simply citing what seems to me pretty clearly the evidence, and I've explained to you why the evidence I see in the IFS data and in the household average incomes data, I'm trying to explain earlier why that has happened. It's a combination of the interaction of what's happening in the financial services industry and benefits relative to earnings. On what you say on graduates, that I'm afraid, again, is it is so misleading, this pessimism about graduate prospects. When the recession hit, unemployment amongst all groups increased. However, it remains the case that going to university is one of the most transformational things that people can do, and there is no evidence whatsoever that the boost you get in your life chances or in your lifetime earnings has in any way fallen. It is still a great thing to do. And the more this kind of strange alliance between some people on the left and the Daily Mail, oh, it's no point going to university, they're all unemployed, what's the point, is very dangerous indeed. On housing, I agree with you. On housing, which is the crucial, as people now try to investigate to what extent is the Piketty argument correct, it looks as if the crucial point in Piketty that stands is an increase in wealth inequality driven by the change in the value of housing assets. I've written a book about this. I completely get that. That's why it is incredibly important that we build more housing and that we do provide opportunities for young people to get started on the housing ladder. So try to disentangle the different threads and focus on the things where the evidence is with you, and then let's work together on practical things to solve the problem.
I talked about taxation earlier. I do think that Danny Dorling has written a big book about housing inequality. He makes the point that it's not so much that we've not got enough houses, it's that the space in the existing housing stock is so maldistributed. You've got a lot of people living in very big houses that they don't need to live in since they occupy all the rooms. And you've got a lot of other people crowded in tiny flats. This phenomenon of hutching. And one of the reasons why this is taking place is that we are still operating with 1991 property values. The council tax is still, for the maximum amount of council tax you will pay in the most valuable house in London remains £3,350 that you would have paid in 1991. And actually, wouldn't it be fabulous if tomorrow, George Osborne would stand up and say, we're not going to carry on with 1991 property values. We're going to have a revaluation. We're going to introduce more bans. And actually, what you would then do is you then actually start to free the market up a bit. People are living in big houses who might not need them anymore. Might think, hell, I don't want to pay £10,000, £12,000, £14,000 in tax. I'll trade down. The whole thing is gummed up. You have these big concentrations of wealth at top because the whole thing is untaxed.
If you had a society building 300,000 homes a year,
of course,
or 140,000,
I agree with that.
Okay,
but
I don't think it's only.
I think it's also about the distribution of the existing stock as well as not adding to it.
Well, just firstly, and what you keep doing, what the government has done for a long time is gone off the initial impacts of a financial crisis and the measures introduced by the last Labour government. Before the election in 2010, if you were to look at the impact of your policies, of your government, whether it comes to taxes, increasing VAT, for example, or cutting benefits in real terms, then it's regressive. And the IFS has made that point. The second worst affected group in society, because of the policies of your government, is the bottom 20%. And that is beyond dispute. Now, the other point is you are very conveniently sticking to the top 20%. As I've already told you, if you look, for example, at the Sunday Times Rich List, the wealth of the richest 1,000 people has doubled in the last few years. And similarly, if we were to look at working people, over 1 million workers, disproportionately women, have been driven into poverty pay since your government came to power. So I simply don't accept the image that you're painting, which I'm afraid, in my opinion, doesn't bear relationship to the facts.
But you're talking about the whole of society or 1,000, you're talking about wealth or income.
I'm looking at a whole range of measures.
Let me give you some friendly advice about. If I were wanting to make a socialist case, if you want to make a case for socialism, you can't hide behind an argument. There's 1,000 people over there that somehow are the source of the problem or the source of the money.
I'm the chair. I'm allowed to say something. Listen. Isn't the point about the kind of whether you use the top quintile and the bottom quintile that actually because income stagnation has stretched all the way up to the 90th centile, that actually the top 20% isn't a very good measure because the 19% is making the 1% look poorer than they are. And that evidence is quite well established. That was in Tom Clark's book a year ago.
The 20%, the least... Well, I stand by the point I made earlier. The least affluent 20%, because, indeed, benefits fell less than wages did, and because of what's happening in financial services, I stand by my point. Now, you can slice it and dice it in lots of different ways. You can move around between the top 1,000, you count their wealth, not their
income. But it's not about slicing and dicing, is it? It's about saying, has inequality intensified between 99% and 1%? And you can't mask that by only comparing the bottom 20 with the top 20.
I've not seen any evidence. I mean, I'm happy to study it. I've not seen the evidence that the top
1%. Actually, I just say, and I, in this fabulous book you're all going to buy after this event, the point is that the top 0.1% share has actually broadly held. The top 1% has actually fallen a bit. But actually, when you talk about the top 20%, I think people should be clear. You know, you can, and I'm used to doing it, to show of hands. I mean, 9/10 of people in Britain make less than £42,000 a year. So it's not a lot of... Yeah. When David talks about the top 20%, he's actually talking about a bunch of people who range from incomes around £35,000 to kind of £10 million. It's kind of not a kind of...
Polly Toynbee wrote an excellent book about this point. She's absolutely right. What the average perception of what constitutes middle income or whatever is indeed highly skewed. Polly is very powerful on that. But can we just note in passing what Will just said about these 0.1% and the 1%? If people have got empirical evidence and can show me what it is, I'm happy to consider it. But for the time being, I'm going to go on what I've read from the IFS and what Will has just said.
You know what? We can bandy around the stats.
Let me just say
one thing before Sheila goes. Yeah. Because Sheila was very sort of heartfelt, sobbing about part-time women workers. Yeah. And I would say that the best protection for part-time women workers, or even full-time workers, is the trade union movement, which has the rights, which is able to help them. I just wanted to make that point before you went.
I didn't catch that. So, sorry.
Yeah.
It's the trade union movement.
Well, that's how you protect people in the world of work. Well, I just wanted to say
we have a labour market model which has seen, and the more intervention the government has done on this, whatever it's done, it's got it wrong, because the more intervention we've had... This has happened since the 1990s. This trend has been going on since the 1990s. We have had a very interventionist
Inequality rose under the last Labour.
I'm talking about the part-time women working.
I don't want to keep you, and I'm not going to persuade you. I'm not going to persuade you about the virtue of organised trade unions. Yeah. But I want to just come back to this thing about graduates, and just so it's beyond doubt. Obviously, the more people go to university, the better. Obviously, university is a transformative experience. My parents left school at 14. I'm a British Member of Parliament. My university made the difference. But let's be clear. People are emerging from university today not just loaded down with debt, but then going on to do jobs which, when I was a teenager, you could do with A-levels. And it's just not enough to say we've got more people who are graduates, therefore they're in some absolute sense better off, because that's not the reality of people's lives.
Right. Okay. Right. Good. More questions from the floor. Who's got a question? Oh, look, there's loads over there. You in the glasses, and then you in the glasses. That was so imprecise.
Hi. At the beginning of the debate, we talked about coming up with possible solutions to the inequality problem. I think that's something we haven't spoken as much about. I think Owen's covered some, but I'd be interested to hear what all the panel have to say about the idea of increasing the minimum wage to the living wage, thereby reducing the tax credits bill. People who are given extra money will spend it, which will generate economic activity, and people will be given a wage that they can live off, which surely should be a minimum in any civilised society.
Okay. So where are we on wages? Who wants to start on wages?
Well, I think that you've got to move to a living wage, and in London, you've got to move to a London living wage. And although it's unfashionable, I don't think we should ignore the role of taxation in creating more equal societies. Britain was a more equal society when it had a more progressive taxation system, and that involves taxing assets like property. Not with the mansion tax, which is a misconceived tax, but we should certainly do something about council tax, which completely understates the value of properties now.
Yeah,
of course, yeah. I mean, that's an absolutely key point. And not only would increasing the minimum wage in that way reduce the amount we spend on in-work benefits without cutting them, which, I mean, do bear in mind what the government is planning tomorrow, by all accounts, is an attack on in-work benefits, which won't be increasing people's wages. And bear in mind the living wage, by the way, is taking into account, and this is a really important point, in-work benefits. Mm. So if you're getting rid of those in-work benefits, the living wage goes up to about £11.50, for example. So it is dependent on those in-work benefits. So even if you had a living wage, people would still need in-work benefits to meet their costs. So that's an important point. But we do need to increase the minimum wage because that will, for one thing, decrease automatically, not just tax credits, but housing benefit, because the vast majority of new claimants of housing benefit are people who are in work. One in four London households now claim housing benefit. Now, that is partly a function of our failure to build housing, and we should be giving councils the powers that, again, that notorious lefty Boris Johnson, of all people, has called for, to give them those borrowing powers so they can actually borrow to invest, to build housing, which could create jobs, stimulate the economy as well. But we know when low-paid workers get extra money in their pockets, they go out and spend it, whilst if you cut the taxes of the rich off and they go and pop it in a bank or in a tax haven somewhere. So that's good for the economy, good for local businesses. So I think, obviously, that's an obvious part to an obvious place to start. And unfortunately, what we're going to see tomorrow, and do be careful, because the opposition at the moment has basically gone AWOL. So the rest of us have to fill that vacuum, and they are going to unleash a raid on the people patronised repeatedly by politicians as hard-working Brits who do the right thing. Well, now they're about to come for their in-work benefits. We'll see how far that patronising works in future.
David, where are you on minimum wage and living wage?
I'm afraid I'm going to be the boring vote of caution on this, and heavily influenced by my excellent colleague at the Resolution Foundation, Gavin Kelly. In London, I think what you say is right. In London, with the costs that people face in London and with the buoyancy of the London jobs market, I can see very powerful arguments for living wage. It isn't the case that increasing the minimum wage to living wage would somehow sort of save us lots of money in tax credits, but it would be a good thing to do in London. I'm not at all sure that it would have a overall beneficial effect in other parts of the country. And although my party were clearly wrong when I said, and several of us said, when Labour brought in the minimum wage, there'll be millions of people unemployed, that did not happen. Nope. We've got lessons to learn from that. But there comes a point when it would happen. And the reason why we have a low pay commission on a cross-party basis is the low pay commission, unlike the people estimating the living wage, have to make some estimate of the labour market impact. And there would come some point when, especially, I have to say, younger people trying to get into jobs would find themselves excluded if you pushed that wage up too fast, too high, across the country on a uniform basis.
What can I say? I'm Prince of Oxford College. It was the first college in Oxford to pay the living wage. So there you go.
Oh.
I'm passionate
living,
so there you are. I'm essentially, of course, with Owen, you know, who's leading the opposition at the moment. Our opposition leader, Owen Jones, I give you. We're living through a period of incredible, you know, change. I mean, digitization, you know, march of science, kind of business model after business model, kind of being challenged. I mean, as a Guardian event, I'm actually on the Scott Trust that we own. I'm one of the dozen people responsible for keep the Guardian going as it's going heretofore, and making sure it's kind of around in 30, 40, 50 years' time. But, you know, one thing we puzzle about is actually, you know, where are we going to get the revenue from in 5, 10 years, and, you know, to pay for our journalists and our journalism? Is it going to be, are you going to pay for it on a mobile phone? Or are you going to read the long read, you know, 4,000 words on your mobile? And what kind of journalism will we be providing? So, you know, and it's the same across the board. I mean, everyone's in this kind of facing a kind of problematic, difficult change. And it's not, it's not so easy to suddenly say, you know, let's just ram up the living wage, or let's just, because we have to think kind of much more completely about how we get at the totality of our economic and social structures right, it seems to me.
But when you did your work on pay spines and comparisons between the top and the bottom, didn't you, I mean, maybe I'm misrepresenting it, but you concluded from that, didn't you, that actually if you did try and get some discipline within the pay spine, then the wages at the bottom would go up naturally.
No, but, I mean, what that was. I mean, I still don't know whether that was the... And I was asked if we could introduce a 20-to-1 pay ratio in Britain. And I got so near to saying, yes, we bloody should. and actually, I've often... And actually, what I came up with was actually a system for monitoring wages at the top. I thought people who get top pay should put some of their pay at risk and earn it back only if they performed. But you're right. I mean, I wanted, and I was glad to see that Labour had it in their manifesto. I wanted representatives of the workforce, you know, on remuneration committees setting directors' salaries. And it's this kind of, you know, when Diane talks about union, she's right. We've got to think cleverly about how you would use union power in a way that, you know, the public at large was considered legitimate. I was really dismayed to see Aslef maybe coming out tomorrow and Thursday, you know, thinking, oh, shit, how am I going to get around London? And I'm in favour of unions, and I can imagine a lot of my fellow Londoners not being so warm about them as we are in this hall. And, you know, we've got to think of ways in which, you know, in the private sector, we can re-legitimise trade unions. You know, we won't get a vibrant social-democratic left. We won't do some of the things that, you know, I want to see unless we get growing numbers of people joining private sector trade unions that do feasible things. And so what could those feasible things be? Well, one of them could be sitting on remuneration committees to help determine pay, all that kind of stuff. And I just think that it's great kind of, you know, well, it's got to be more complete about the way it all connects, you know. You can't just say what living wage without thinking about the knock-on things.
Well, just to reinforce your point, and actually Dan's point earlier, and that is the point about the role of trade unions and collective bargaining, because if we look at the Nordic economies, for example, Finland, where about 70% of their workers are unionised, about the same in countries like Belgium as well, and they obviously have far less inequality than we do. Finland has hugely less inequality than Britain does, and they have higher living standards and higher wages than we do, and that's because of that role of trade unions and in terms of collective bargaining, because actually Finland doesn't actually have a living wage, would you believe, but they do have such extensive collective bargaining it operates as a replacement. And it is true that in the private sector now only 14% of private sector workers are unionised. That's over half in the public sector. And that has a huge impact in places like call centres, over 1 million working call centres, as many as work down the mines at the peak of the mining industry. Retail, one of the biggest industries in the country, very low levels of unionisation. That's partly because of the nature of work. It's more transient. You don't have communities based around supermarkets in the way you had communities based around steelworks. So you have to have a new form of organising, and unions have to adapt. We also have to look at the very stringent anti-trade union laws as well, of course, which make it often very difficult for unions to organise. So it's about challenging those union laws, but also trade unions adapting and trying to adjust and organise in a situation where work is so transient and you don't have the same basis of communities based around workplaces. But we can do that, and if we do that by learning from countries like the Nordic countries, we can increase our wages. So it's not just a living wage, it's trade unions, and that will... create a far more equal society, to go back to
can
the
I, can I just make okay, a
one tiny quiet thing, and then we have to have another
Sorry,
question.
Yeah. I just wanted to say on this that if I were trying to... I think employers do have greater social obligations than they're currently discharging. If I were trying to push an agenda for expecting more of employers, mine would focus more on a commitment to training their workforce than on moving from the minimum wage to the living wage. I actually think that and in the long run, investment in skills and training would be a better bet. And secondly, to say, I had the experience of trying to operate a narrowing pay gap model. Because when the coalition came in 2010, we absolutely had an aim, influenced by this shift in our thinking towards the importance of inequality, that at least, although we can, within the public sector and the public services, narrow pay gaps. So we always had pay increases for the least well-paid, and we had an elaborate system of controls if anybody wanted to earn more than the Prime Minister and all that. And by the end, I have to say, as a science minister, I was endlessly writing to the chief secretary, Danny Alexander, asking him permission for some group of incredibly smart scientists at one of our research institutes to be paid more than the prime minister, because otherwise they'd go off to America or they'd had some amazing bid from Singapore or whatever. Actually, operating it was hard. But if you look, you will find that we did indeed succeed in narrowing pay differentials in the things that we are most responsible for, namely across the public sector.
Okay. By the way, it's worth saying that one of the things that David did in office, I mean, he was an architect of a German-style industrial strategy. I mean, no one says it, but it needs to be
said.
The
German-style industrial strategy of narrowing pay gaps, is that what you mean?
No, beyond that, I mean, he was, science catapults. Set up these councils for these industry councils with Vince Cable, a bunch of stuff that I think the current business secretary will dismantle. But there you are. I mean, it was an attempt to create a kind of British industrial strategy. I mean, it was quite, you know.
Okay, Bruce.
Hi. So my question on inequality is, although we're in London, is about the rural economy. So one of the things which is creating that inequality is the planning system. So we've got a system now which is largely controlled by people with lots of time and independent income, stopping things happening in rural economies that they don't like the look of, for the most part. And do you think that's the right basis for developing what is where still the majority of people live, just about, and could work, but their children leave because they've got no jobs to go to? So, and I'm specifically talking there about the renewable energy industry, which has been shafted several times by the Tories in various forms, and is about to be shafted again, just because they don't like the look of things that they make. So I'm just wondering, is that the basis for generating equality, that it's sort of like an aesthetic decision to protect the countryside, or should we be looking at renewable energy for what it is, which is basically the biggest inward investment into the rural economy we're going to be able to make, leveraged by, yes, a government subsidy of upward to about $9 billion, which will generate more than $100 billion in inward investment into the rural economy, which is bigger than anything we've ever done. And yet we seem determined to follow the inequality that says that the people in charge of the planning system are the people with the most money and the biggest houses. So how are we going to address that particular inequality? Because it's much more pernicious than the one you all experience in the urban environment. You're seeing the complete decimation of villages, where children are leaving to go and get actual jobs as opposed to working for the rich people that have stopped the development in their local community.
Yeah. So is the question, should we relax planning?
How do you change planning?
Okay, so okay.
We don't discuss this much, but we talk about deindustrialization. There's also this phenomenon, and I think you're talking to it really, of de-ruralization. Mm-hmm. You're seeing villages right around the country kind of just being eviscerated. I mean, there's no shop, there's no post office, mm-hmm. increasingly, as you say, the ownership of the. Bigger and bigger houses. The people with second houses don't live in them. I mean, it's an absolute gutting of the rural economy. I've called it de-ruralization, if you like. I mean, the kind of emptying out of the countryside. And you are right. I mean, it's creating phenomenal inequalities between small villages and actually the market towns that serve them, and then the bigger towns. There's a whole new hierarchy of opening up. I'm not entirely certain it's to do with, it's partly to do with planning. I mean, you're right. But it comes back to my, you know, I'm so against this moves on inheritance tax.
Yeah.
And it's part of the story here. I mean, I know this, the right call the inheritance tax a death tax. I call it we share in your good luck tax. And I, you know, I find the idea that, you know, we're going to kind of create property dynasties in which, you know, if you're lucky enough to come out, spring out of the loins of XYZ person who bought a property in 1980, then actually, and in the right place or in the right village, with the right plot of ground behind it, that now is a very fashionable second home for some Russian oligarch or some hot Russian money. Big program tomorrow night on Channel 4 to watch, by the way, on this. But the that actually all this is going to be protected over time. So we as a country become complicit in the construction of kind of dynasties at the top, in the name of wanting to kind of not have a death tax, and hundreds and millions of actually fellow countrymen kind of voting happily for this in the name of aspiration, because they aspire not to pay inheritance tax either. It's an extraordinary situation. So that, you know, it's not only about planning; it's also about kind of tax structures which permit us to help dynasties. It's of the type I've discussed. It's also about the way that land tenure is organised in the country, that actually you have no small landowners. It's all big estates. 24 English dukes own more of England in 2012, which is the last time we looked at it, than did when the big survey was done in the 1880s. And by the way, most of that land is held offshore. So the Duke of Marlborough, who owns most of North Oxfordshire and now going into Gloucestershire, owns all that in Liechtenstein trusts. So if you're a young man or woman who want to set up a farm or a small business in David Cameron's constituency in Witney, your chance of buying even a small holding is zero. It's all held in Liechtenstein. So the combination of actually the inheritance tax provisions and the way we operate the tax code means that actually it becomes impossible to kind of re-ruralise and bring life back to the rural economy. It's not just about planning.
David... Shall we skip to the next question? Does anybody else have... Yeah, OK, good. So there's a gentleman over there, also with glasses.
I just want to ask David to come out from behind this equation, which equates anybody concerned with inequality with being a lefty or being a socialist. I have some friends in America. One's my nephew, and one I was brought up in high school with, and two others. They're all multimillionaires. Two of them, I think, are billionaires. And they're alarmed as hell about inequalities. They keep talking about the things that Will was saying. About anybody that looks down the road, they say, can see that just feeding shareholder values is going to create such great inequalities, it's all going to blow up. They're worried about rising crime. They're worried about rising mental health rates. They're worried about inequalities, and these people vote Republican. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you... And I mean, it's possible they haven't seen your data on the 20%, and if they did, they might change their minds. But at the moment, I don't think it's just lefties. I think anybody that's rational is very concerned about inequalities.
Okay, that wasn't really a question. I liked it.
No, just quick, I mean, Warren Buffett, a very rich man, as I'm sure you know, he, of course, famously said, there is a class war going on, and it's my side fighting it, and we're winning. And, you know, I mean, Dave keeps trying to brush aside the point about the top 1,000, and the point there is... Their wealth, just the increase since the collapse of Lehman Brothers, if you want to make a comparison, is 2.5 times the annual deficit run by this country. It's a huge amount of wealth concentrated in the hands of very few people. I think that's irrational, but I think lots of people who are very rich indeed would regard that as an irrational concentration of wealth and power in our society. I think it's bad for everybody. I think it scars and disfigures our society, and I think we could welcome anybody, whatever their background, who makes that point.
Okay.
I do accept that inequality is a problem. Of course, if you didn't get that, I didn't explain myself very clearly. What I'm trying to do is to try to establish what the facts are, to make it clear some of the things that we have done which are aimed at reducing inequality, such as the attempt to reduce pay gaps in the public sector, and to propose practical things that would further reduce inequality. And I've made several proposals in the course of this evening. Okay. So, yes, I agree.
OK, I'm going to go to this question here, and then to you. So I have,
being 21 plus tax, I've grown up in a number of decades here in England, and actually most of my time in Tory areas. When I was growing up, there were a diverse range of people in a community. They were rich, they were middle class, they were poor. But there was a diverse range of people, and there was social mobility of sorts. Now, what I've heard this evening, and I've been listening very carefully, is we've talked about models, we've talked about the top 20%, we've talked about this. Now, if you build in a model, the impression I'm getting is that those people who are building the models are very, very are right at the top of the pyramid, and they are benefiting from it. So the variables they're going to put in the models is going to come from their experience. Whereas back when I was growing up, there were strikes when things were not right, there were marches when things were not right, the community had the same when things were not right. So the variables that may have gone into the models were very broad-based, which were probably happening in places like Finland. But now we get people building models on their experience of how things should go, and these are very, very short-term. So when somebody else comes up and comes up with another model, which is short-term, that same thing happens. And I think that is increasing the inequality because they do not understand what the vast majority of the population feel, and they do not listen to the ideas of the vast portion of the community who have an idea of what things may be working in their area. Mm-hmm. It's just a suggestion. I'd like to know what you think about it.
Yeah. Diane, what do you think of that?
I think the unfortunate thing is that the political consensus on issues like inequality has moved to the right, despite, you know, the work of somebody like Owen. And someone said there about, you know, any rational person must understand inequality is a problem. But you know something, and I don't want anyone to hiss or boo, but Ed Miliband, at the heart of his offer coming up to the last general election, was a concern about inequality. And election night was scarcely over before people in my own party were jumping up and down saying, oh, it was far too left-wing, it was all too left-wing, we shouldn't be talking about inequality, we're talking about aspiration. So, I mean, I'm making a serious point that there is a wing in politics, and they're not just conservatives, yeah, that didn't want to talk about inequality and don't want to talk about it now. And why this event's important and why the work of some of the people on this platform is important is we have to push back, because the consensus has moved to what Owen said right at the beginning, that somehow if you're doing well, it's, and I don't think this before David jumps in, somehow if you're doing well, it's to do with some moral merit that you have, but if you're doing badly, you're a benefit street person, you're not worthy of concern, we're going to cut your benefit.
I think you're fears that somehow the people who are trying to collect this data are unrepresentative, which they probably are, and therefore giving a misleading picture. I think that's a bit harsh on the social science community in Britain and organisations like the Institute of Fiscal Studies that does try to collect the data. So I think we have to accept that the kind of data that I've been drawing on today is not provided by a group of people who have a conscious or unconscious bias. Ironically, hearing what you say, the person what your intervention reminded me of is Ian Duncan Smith, who was in the process of saying all these people are doing their clever models of exactly how you measure poverty today, and instead he wants to look at worklessness and educational opportunities and all that. So there's always going to be an argument about how you try to measure dynamic change against pictures of income, and there is more to life than income. But I think it would be a mistake to reject the data on income on the basis that somehow it's produced by people who are biased.
Okay.
Of the people that they have, because any model you build up, that you can't put in every single variable, and many of the people who have the opportunity to even enter a PhD in one of these universities are certainly not going to come from the from a background of suffering and not having exposure to a wide range of things. And your thinking does change. And I, because I've seen both sides of the coin.
Yep.
And I'm talking from experience. I know what it is like when you have a lot of opportunities. Yeah. And I know what it's like when you don't have a lot of opportunities. So I've seen both sides of the coin, and that's why I'm talking the way I am. I'm sorry if I sound too passionate about it.
That's brilliant. And then we'll go up to the balcony.
I'm not quite sure how inequality can be, questioned in any way when 1 million people went to food banks last year in the UK, and a very large proportion of those were in work. How can that possibly be acceptable in one of the world's richest nations?
Okay, I'm going to take that as a comment and then go to this question up here.
Hi, I'd like to challenge your views on education. I'm a lecturer in a university. I'm on an hourly pay contract. I have nearly a PhD. I have done everything that you can possibly do to become as educated as possible. And I am like thousands of people in this country, but yet I am on a casual contract. And that is the scourge of this society. It is wrong. And furthermore, it pulls down the working rights of every person in this country, because what it does is it destroys our trade unions, it destroys our ability to organise. I'd like to take you back to a little article that was in The Guardian a few months ago about the FE teacher who couldn't put food on her child's table. She couldn't bear the insecurity. It was driving her mind mad. Do you Tories have any idea what it's like to live like that, to not be able to pay your mortgage, to not know whether you can earn money for the next week for your child? I think you live in an unreal world, and I want a socialist society where wealth is shared up properly. Okay. My question, what are you going to do about this?
I'm going to take that as a comment and take this question.
David, I'd like to ask you, can you justify, after a crash that was caused by the bankers, and as you well know, of a scale of £1.3 trillion that we had to bail them out, why did you immediately after that, or virtually a couple of months after that, why did George Osborne introduce cuts? Can you see the picture behind you? Austerity cuts on people that are on the poorest in society, and you dropped the income tax of the super rich from 50% to 45%, and on top of which, you wouldn't accept a Robin Hood tax on the banks. Who caused the crash? That is unjustifiable and unfair, sir. Why are you so unfair?
I think probably there's several. Let me try to answer some of this stuff. Look, first of all, I fully accept that in modern Britain there are people struggling to manage on very low incomes. And nobody's trying to pretend otherwise. And actually, one of the great system advantages of a system of being a constituency MP is that you are every week, and I no longer have those responsibilities, but you're every week confronted with exactly the types of examples of human distress and financial pressure that people have just been citing. When we turned up in government in May 2010 in coalition, the fact that I think people are wrong to imagine, are underestimating the genuine concern that with a country that was borrowing 11% of national income, that the idea that you could just carry on with low interest rates and without having to tackle the deficit. When I sat alongside Vince Cable in Biz, the one thing that Vince, through thick and thin, recognised was that we inherited a budget deficit that was unsustainable and had to be reduced. And if you look at the figures, about what we then did about it, that's why it's so important, the fact that, thank heavens, because benefits were doing better than wages, and because of the bank levy, because of the pressures in the financial services industry, it is not the case that what we then did drove increasing inequality.
We don't need a Tory party political.
Well, hang on, I was just being Why asked. Hang on. I had some legitimate questions about the record of the last Conservative government.
The question was, why was the deficit reduced on the backs of some people and not on the backs of other people? It wasn't, did you have to reduce the deficit?
But if you look at the balance of the measures that we took, the people who took the biggest hit were quite rightly the most affluent.
Well,
that's
ones?
Where Those were the people whose tax burden increased a lot. If you look at any analysis of the distribution impact of the measures that we took, it is not the case that somehow the burden was borne by the poor. That wasn't how we set out. That's not how Cabinet discussed things, and it's not what happened. Thank heaven.
Okay, Owen wants to come back.
The underlying premise of the austerity programme, of course, was that the last Labour government had spent too much money on schools and hospitals. Now, the Conservatives... The Conservatives backed that spending pound for pound until the end of 2008, and they should never, ever, ever have been able to get away by the Labour leadership, who are responsible, with revising that record when they backed every single penny. Now, in terms of what happened, the financial crisis which caused the deficit, the large deficit that we have today, you obviously promised to wipe out that deficit in 5 years. That clearly did not happen. You've added more debt than every Labour government put together in history. And rather than having a policy based on growth, now if we instead, the reason partly the Tory government struggled so much to bring down that deficit is if you have a reliance on creating low-paid jobs where people depend on in-work benefits, they're not paying taxes, and they're not outspending in the economy, then that deficit, you're going to struggle to bring that deficit down. And that's exactly what happened. Now, the point about food banks, I just think, is a key point because... You know, this is the sixth biggest economy on the face of the earth. Not one single person should be driven to a charity to satisfy that most basic of human needs, to eat. The Red Cross is organising food packages for the first time since the end of World War II. And partly, actually, it comes back, and I just want to make this point about inequality. I mean, just quickly about casualisation, really important point. Academia is now becoming one of the most casualised sectors. And it reminds me of dock workers marching to the yard in the morning and sticking their hands up, hoping to get work off and to go home disappointed. Now I meet young people getting text messages at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's including self-employed people, many of whom are registered as self-employed but lack basic security, basic rights, no pensions, no paid sick leave, and all the rest of it. But I want to end by making this point about, and it is a key point about inequality, it links to food banks. The banks plunged this country into economic calamity. They became Britain's most lavished benefit claimant, hundreds of billions of pounds of public money. But the difference with other benefit claimants was so little was asked in return. They paid more bonuses than every other European Union country put together to those at the top. This government took the EU to court in an attempt to stop them limiting those bonuses. They weren't lending to small businesses, all the rest of it. Now, compare that to hundreds of thousands of people each year who have their benefits sanctioned. That means that their pathetic, paltry support from the state, pathetic amounts, are stopped on the basis they fail to abide by the strict conditions attached to support to receiving support from the state. And I'll give you an example. A 60-year-old army veteran called Stephen Taylor. And this Mancunian army veteran was desperately looking for work. And he was looking for work in a supermarket where he was selling poppies for the Royal Legion for maimed and injured former comrades of his. And he didn't get work there, but he was trying his best. And at the age of 60, if you're out of work and you can't get a job, it's tough, it's hard. He had his benefits stopped, sanctioned for 4 weeks on the basis his volunteering for the Royal Legion showed he wasn't trying hard enough to look for work. So compare and contrast. Those at the top can plunge this country into one of the worst economic calamities it has ever suffered in modern times, with huge amounts of state support, no questions asked. For those at the bottom, that's the state support ever more conditional. Do you know what that is? It's socialism for the rich, and it's capitalism sink or swim for those at the bottom. And that is one of the key inequalities that divides our society.
Can I just make one comment in response to the kind of intervention from the alternative leader of the opposition, and it's this. I think that analysis is just plainly incorrect. If you look at the type of things we've tried to do to sort out the financial services industry, the combination of the regulations, the types of legislation, the bank levy, it's not correct. But I think it's wrong in a deeper sense, which is that what happened under Labour, and indeed, during some of those years, my party accepted the spending plans, what happened under Labour was that the deficit gradually grew, even though the economy was growing rapidly. So although when the crash came, it completely knocked the finances, the trends were already in the wrong direction. And there is not, and for any person who really wants to have an effective Labour government, there is not a small group of bad people who you can suddenly go to finance all the kind of things that you want to do. If you want to make a case for socialism, it's not that. If you want to make a case for socialism, it's that we are all in this society. All of us need to pay higher taxes. It's not the case that 1,000 rich people or a group of bankers will finance the British welfare state. And you have to accept that what went wrong with Labour pre the crash was they were not willing to accept that the generality of taxpayers would have to pay for the public programmes they are introducing. That's why, even in the good years, the deficit was growing. That is responsible socialism. A group of bankers beating up on a group of bankers who none of us are going to defend is not responsible socialism.
Diane, do you want to come back quickly on Labour, and then Will, do you want to make a final remark, and then
I'm amazed that David Willetts is still repeating this Tory party political thing. We did all we did because of Labour's spending on schools and hospital. And just let me say this. I would say, actually, that Labour could have done more in opposition to contest that whole benefit street narrative. We could have done more, you know, in opposition to challenge austerity. But, you know, you keep quoting these statistics, the IFS, this, that and the other. I can only tell you about people's lived experience. And I know what life was like for me when I left university in the 80s and had an opportunity of a stable job, the possibility of buying a home, some kind of prospect. And I know what life is like for young people now, coming out of university, loaded with debt, and at the very best, going into what are now highly casualised white-collar occupations. So in the end, you have to counter your selected stats with the reality of people's lived expectations. And I'm afraid they don't match.
Wait, okay. I want to end on a positive note. Will, do you have any reason to think that we can do some of the things we need to combat inequality? Or is it are all the answers political, and are we in a kind of impasse?
I think that inequality is a political choice. By the way, I do think that, although everyone's given David a hard time, and very brave of him to come into that. I have to say, he chairs the Resolution Foundation. He's the author of Industrial Strategy, and he's a decent Tory, so, you know. There's a... And by the way, you know, meet some others. So that's just a thing to say. A good man, basically. Now, I do think inequality is a political choice. I do think we've created structures over the last 35 years that have created more of it. We've discussed a lot of it tonight. Mm. I mean, my big point about... I don't think I would define a left position as only about public spending and public borrowing. I mean, we have to kind of return to the big questions that the left used to try to wrestle with. Who owns what? How are they going to be... what are the countervailing powers going to be? You know, what is our position on liberty, on human rights? You know, it isn't... I used to get angry in the early 80s when the left defined itself just as unilateral disarmament, and I think to define it now as just against the cuts is also enough. Well, I'm glad I've got a little bit of applause for that. But, you know, having said that, I see there's nothing magic about public expenditure being 35.5% of GDP, which George Osborne is aiming for. It could easily be 37-38% taxation as a share of GDP. And if it were that higher, then you would have 30, 40, 50 billion pounds extra that you could spend, and you could spend on the kind of stuff we've talked about tonight. Where could you raise that money? I think you could raise that money from reorganising our taxation, particularly on property and wealth, which I think has got intensely unequal. I also think there's money to be raised by broadening the VAT base, from income tax, from taxing environmental bads. I mean, it's not difficult to think of ways in which, to raise this money. What I would say to David is that I, 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 You know, a deficit of 11% of GDP in Britain had to be tackled. But here's the point. You didn't have to do 98% of the reduction through cutting public spending. We could have... a third, a half could have been done by raising taxes, as the Labour government did in the 1970s in the IMF crisis. And actually, in fairness, you know, Ken Clark did alongside, you know, that Tory administration of 92 to 97 did raise taxes by that amount. It wasn't necessary for the entire burden to be shouldered by expenditure cuts with the disastrous effect on equality we've been talking about this evening. That's all I would say.
Okay, great. I think we have to leave it. I think we have to leave it there. Unless you really want to say one thing.
Yeah, I do want to say one thing. Because this stuff about schools and hospitals, the issue is, if you want schools and hospitals, and this was my... I can sense I'm in a predominantly Labour audience. So let's...
You've done well
so
there.
So let's think about the famous Ed Miliband TV interview, no, Question Time, during the election.
Yeah,
and how should he have handled the question about if he had any regrets what Labour had done? Because I have to tell you guys, that's the kind of issue. If you want to win next time, banker bashing is not going of itself to be a coherent agenda for the next Labour government.
Okay, thanks for your advice.
And what he should have said, what he could have said was, yes, we wanted that extra spending on health and schools, but we should have genuinely financed it out of the taxation that was needed to pay for it. That's what he didn't...
Let's not disintegrate.
If you want proper socialism, you have to give that kind of honesty about how you pay for it.
Okay, on that note, on that bombshell, can I thank the panel? Thank you, panel. That was very exciting.
I'm a chair.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.